Good evening. Great to see you all this evening. This evening I'm going to be speaking about a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's actually called Themes, is the title of the discourse. But you may know it a little differently. You may know it as because it was converted basically into a chant, or the core of that was converted into a chant called the Five Subjects for Frequent Recollection. And we'll be chanting that this evening. It'll be very exciting. So, and the five subjects are about aging, sickness, death, and karma, or kama, as we call it, the Pali word instead of the Sanskrit word, or either one. They're the same thing, just different languages. And we will be we'll be talking a little bit about. We'll be doing a chant, and so I wanted to do a real little precursor of what chanting is and what purpose it fills and that kind of thing. So it's a way to reflect on a specific topic. It's a reminder about that. Chanting can really kind of drive home the teachings about what things are really important. So from one monastery to another, they might chant different things. In the Amravati lineage, of which Abhayagiri is one of the monasteries there, they, for example, chant the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first discourse of the Buddha, the setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma discourse, where the Buddha gave his first discourse on the Four Noble Truths. And then there will also be many other chants that people will do, some which are basically from discourses that have been converted into chants, or the essence of the discourse converted into a chant. Or there might be things about specific topics that are not necessarily specifically from a discourse, but do serve as reminders, as things to focus on. Kind of a way to uphold what's perceived to be important. And may help to reinforce action that's in accord with the practice of the Sangha, things like that. It's generally done as a group, just as we did our chant here, just as Diane led us in that chant. The Sangha will come together and we'll do these chants, and they may do them in the morning and again in the evening. That's the common way to do it. Couple other things that I think are helpful or interesting about chanting is that while they aren't necessarily this way for everyone, for many people they can be heart opening in some way, or they can allow they can be a skillful way to kind of shift energy. So that may be the case for you or not. Okay, so I am gonna go ahead, and if I can have my assistants who were not known that they were going to be assisting me this evening, if I could have you come and just hand these out to people. Please don't read ahead. I'm going to start with just the 5 seconds side. Yeah. Thank you. Don't have enough, we may have to have some people share. It might be good. I think that'd be good.
Anybody else?
Wow, perfect, huh? Great. Okay. So, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my kama heir to my kamma, born of my kamma, related to my kamma, kamma, karma, same Pali versus Sanskrit once again, abide supported by my kamma. Whatever kamma I shall do for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Thus we should frequently recollect. So let's chant it. Ready? Fasten your seatbelts. I'll guide you. So we'll do a call and response. I'll do a line. And actually the first line that I'm going to do is the one that's traditionally, that the chant leader traditionally does, but it's not listed on here. Now let us chant the five subjects for frequent recollection. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging.
I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging.
I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness.
I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness.
I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying.
I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying.
All that is mine, beloved and pleasing.
All that is mine, beloved and pleasing.
Will become otherwise, will become separated from me.
Will become otherwise, will become separated from me.
I am the owner of my kamma.
I am the owner of my kamma.
Heir to my kamma.
Heir to my kamma.
Born of my kamma.
Born of my kamma.
Related to my kamma.
Related to my kamma.
Abide supported by my kamma.
Abide supported by my kamma.
Whatever kamma I shall do.
Whatever kamma I shall do.
For good or for ill.
For good or for ill.
Of that I will be the, I will be the heir.
Of that I will be the heir.
Thus we should frequently recollect.
Thus we should frequently recollect.
Oh, this is some... Now what I'd like to do is talk about this in a little more detail here. The first three, aging, sickness, and death. Anybody recognize those? Yeah. The heavenly messengers, we hear those a lot, right? In this discourse, so it starts with how each of us are subject to aging, sickness, and death. And then this discourse, it says, for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am subject to old age, I am not exempt from old age. In their youth, beings are intoxicated with their youth. And when they are intoxicated with their youth, they engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. But when one reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to old age, I am not exempt from old age. If you've been hanging around the Dharma circles for long, you have certainly heard about aging, sickness, and death. But I found this really beautiful, the teaching from the Buddha here. So it starts in this discourse that the young are intoxicated with youth. And then it continues on the next part. The healthy are intoxicated with health, as if we're under a spell by it, you know? We think our health is permanent. Well, if it's just going along this way, oh, then the back happens, or some condition comes up, a serious health condition, or something more mysterious, some condition that can't necessarily be readily identified. So really what the Buddha said with this is that because of not clearly seeing our condition, we either do or say or think things that cause harm, either to ourselves or others. Yeah. So anybody here, have you ever blamed yourself about being sick? I see a few. Well, okay, right? Just about everybody. Yeah, it's like some failure on our part, right? We get sick. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have gone out. I knew I shouldn't have hugged that person when they said they had a cold. I heard them cough. What was I thinking? You know. That, or what about disability? You know, there's often plenty of blame there. You know, either it's blaming ourselves for what we did, or we're blaming others or holding them accountable for their condition, or they're holding themselves accountable. Or a very person who maybe have some kind of mental health issue, the very depressed person. You know, well, why don't you just get up and go for a walk? Just go for a walk every day, first thing. You know, get yourself out of that. Shake yourself out of it. Stop thinking about that. Oh, if only it were so simple, huh? Yeah. When my wife was, many years ago, when she was training for a marathon, she thought she had developed an acceptance that anything could happen at any time. She works in hospice and palliative care. She worked in a hospital with kids with cancer. She really had a clear sense of that fragility of life and of health. And before she would go out on these training runs, she would offer blessings to others for their well-being and gratitude for her health and for being able to run. And then, after successfully completing the marathon at some point, she developed a really disabling pain condition. It forced her to stop running, forced her to stop working for many years. And she was shocked. She was really shocked by this. And she found herself thinking, you know, but I wasn't taking my health for granted. You know, why is this happening to me? So she wasn't assuming she would stay healthy, at least on the intellectual level, she wasn't. And yet, how do we really get clear about that? There really is that fragility, the truth of that fragility. The next part in the discourse is about the living. The Buddha says the living are intoxicated with life. We don't think of it that way, do we? You know, we may say we love life. Loving life is great. That's wonderful. But we don't often see where may there be some delusion, some intoxication, some enchantment with it, some sense of permanence that creeps in, of lasting forever, or being unchanging, or being in control of it, right? Anybody here actually in control of their lives? Okay. Right. Yeah. And so, once again, with this one, because of not clearly seeing our condition, we do or say or think things that cause harm to ourselves or others. You know, we don't really think about that we're going to die. You know, we know it intellectually, but the proof is in the pudding. We don't live as if we penetrated this truth. And it is something that we can penetrate over time with practice. So after going through these, all that is mine, beloved, and pleasing will become otherwise, will become separated from me, that we won't be able to hold on to our relationships, our friendships, our possessions, the things that we really like, they're fragile. Anybody ever lost a friend? Okay, raise your hand. Right. everybody. Yeah, it's part of being human. It's part of this existence. And then the fifth subject, the importance of our actions and the intentions that underpin them. So karma, or the Sanskrit karma, or the Pali kamma, when the Buddha used this term, he was really referring to the intention or the motivation that underlies our actions there. So that's how we deal with this. We reflect on these things. And then he talks about kind of how we can work with them, what the noble disciple does. And we often see this in the discourses, the noble disciple. What this means is somebody who has reached at least in Theravada and Buddhism, there are these four stages of four levels of awakening. Mm-hmm. And a noble disciple is somebody who's at least reached this first one. What is often referred to as stream entry. So the noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is subject to old age, not exempt from old age. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, are subject to old age. None are exempt from old age. You also notice here in the discourses there can be a lot of repetition. It was an oral tradition. And then after that, this person is saying this to themselves, and then after that, as they often reflect on this theme, the path is generated. They pursue this path, develop it, and cultivate it. As they do so, the fetters are entirely abandoned, and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. One of the things that I love in some of the first sections of the sutta, we reflect on this, when the young are intoxicated with youth, when the healthy are intoxicated with health, when the living are intoxicated with life. But when one reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth, living, health, possessions, karma, is either completely abandoned or diminished. I think we often see that in the discourses, places where it talks about how we can diminish these things through practice. We can diminish it. It can be a very gradual diminishing. We often here in the West, I think, wrestle with outcome. We really want to get the outcome. We want it to look like this, and we want it to happen by Tuesday. It just doesn't work that way, can be very gradual. Or we set the table with our practice and with our very subtle diminishments, and then there are places where it seems like we're going along, and then, we plunge in somehow, and something is really released. So that's possible there. Yeah. So we don't have to get the whole way there. This is a practice. So I think there's bad news in this reflection, or in these five subjects, and there's good news too. The bad news is they're all true. The good news is we can really radically shift our relationship to them. And in this life, we don't have to wait for disability to come along. It may very well come, I think, I've heard some statistic at some point about how many people end up disabled with a disability at some point during their life. I don't know if anybody's heard that, but it's an extremely high number. If anything, only bedbound or can no longer walk under your own capacity. So karma or kamma, I want to explore this a little bit more. So part of the Buddha's teaching was that our actions produce results. Makes sense, yeah? If I say something kind to somebody, then it might build that relationship. It might not. There's no guarantee. And then the Buddha went further than that. He said the actions produce results corresponding to the kind of the ethical tone of the action or of the intention or motivation that underlies that action. So unwholesome actions are going to produce, or in general, are going to lead towards undesirable results. Wholesome actions are going to, in general, lead towards desirable results. When we die, we can't take anything with us. We can't take our family, our friends, our possessions, our spouses. But we do take our kamma with us. That does come with us. Or maybe not with us, but that carries on forward and becomes, at least according to the Buddha and Theravadan Buddhism, it was one of the Buddha's insights on the night of his enlightenment was seeing beings being reborn based on their kamma, coming and going based on their kamma. May be true, may not be true, don't know. So literally, according to that insight in the Buddhist teachings, Buddhist cosmology, literally we are born of our kamma. Our actions and that ethical quality, the intention that underlies them, will lead to this next rebirth, if we are to have one. And we abide supported by our kamma. So kamma is not just bad news, because we can do those skillful actions, those wholesome actions, and with that comes more desirable results. The Buddha said that there were 10 unwholesome courses of kamma. In other words, certain actions that, if they were followed through, would be strong enough to generate a rebirth in an unwholesome realm, an undesirable realm, in perdition, even in hell. Okay, so I'm going to read some excerpts from this one discourse from Majjhima Nikaya 41, the Brahmins of Sala. So there are actions of body, speech, and mind, and I'll go through them. We'll go through them one by one. Oh, he tells these, he's traveling, and these people, these householders from this town of Sala, have heard that this guy Gotama is coming to their area. He's in the nearby, and they've heard a good report of him. They've heard that he's very accomplished, fully enlightened, so on and so forth. Maybe we should go and see him and see what he has to offer us. And so they go and they ask him, what is the cause and condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in states of deprivation in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell? And what is the cause and condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world? Okay. And so he gives a really short answer, and they're like, can you say more? So he does. Then he goes into the kind of the bulk of the discourse. And he says, householders, another thing great about this discourse, none of us in this room is a monastic. We're all householders. He's speaking to householders here. He's speaking to us in terms of how we can practice and how we can awaken with the Dhamma in our lives, just as it is. Don't have to do the long retreats or anything like that. Householders, there are three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma: unrighteous conduct. There are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma: unrighteous conduct. There are three kinds of mental conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma: unrighteous conduct. In a sec, we'll get to the wholesome ones. So the three kinds of unwholesome conduct. The first, here someone kills living beings. They are murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, they take what is not given. They take by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or forest. Number three, actually in this discourse, it's all using the male pronouns. So this is he or they misconduct themselves in sensual pleasures. He has intercourse with women who are protected by their mother, father, mother and father, brother, sister, or relatives, who have a husband, who are protected by law, and even those who are garlanded in token of betrothal, who are engaged. So, based on a patriarchal culture, we can see that. Today, we might add things such as sexual abuse, sexual assault, groping, leering even, all of those kind of things there. And there are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma. Here someone speaks falsehood when summoned to a court or to a meeting or to his relative's presence or to his guild or to the royal family's presence and questioned as a witness thus, "So, good person, tell what you know." Not knowing, they say, "I know." Or knowing, they say, "I do not know." So, in other words, not being honest. The second kind of verbal misconduct. They speak maliciously. They repeat elsewhere what they have heard here in order to divide those people from these, or they repeat to these people what they have heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus they are one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, who enjoys discord, rejoices in discord, delights in discord, a speaker of words that create discord. Woo. Heavy. Okay. All right. The third verbal misconduct. They speak harshly. They utter words such as are rough, hard, hurtful to others, offensive to others, bordering on anger, unconducive to concentration. Okay? Concentration in the Buddhist practice, being able to develop concentration, and a precursor to that is happiness, ease, relaxation in the body. That's one of the reasons I love doing the movement before we sit, because I find the body can be so, just in such a nice, pleasant state, and it's so conducive to developing, to the mind gathering and unifying. So speaking harshly. Now, that may be cultural. You know, it could be amongst us saying the F word is not appropriate. But I have some other friends who, they say it's somehow when they do it, it just doesn't come out with the harshness. And it's because it's part of the way their culture or the way they've been raised and how they use it to interact with other people. The fourth kind of misconduct that can lead to a course of rebirth, they are a gossip. They speak at the wrong time, speak what is not fact, speak what is useless, speak contrary to the Dhamma and the discipline. At the wrong time, they speak such words as are worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. Okay. So, question for you. What about water cooler talk? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Good?
Sometimes useless, sometimes very helpful.
How much you make the distinction? What's the distinction for you?
Am I responding to something that's real for me and maybe meaningful to the other person? Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mary?
I think, I'm a stepper. But sometimes it's a way of making connections with people and developing really good social interactions. And so for me, it's it's not talking about someone that isn't present, because I think that's just not okay. But it's just having a, you know, where I work a lot of times, we'll talk about, we'll ask sometimes for help, like, this happened, and this is what I did. Do you have any ideas of what could have been better? So sometimes it's like, it's things like that, too, yeah.
A couple of great examples there. Thank you. Yes.
Sometimes even small talk, you know, just as a way of establishing, you know, where people are, where I am, where you are, you know, what I feel good about, you know, indirect, but there, you know.
Yeah. Great. All good answers. Okay. And then there are three kinds of mental conduct, not in accordance with the Dhamma. Here, someone is covetous. They covet the wealth and property of others. Thus, oh, may what belongs to another be mine. Okay? Second one. Or they have a mind of ill will and intentions of hate. Thus, may these beings be slain and slaughtered. May they be cut off, perish, or be annihilated. So not just... I heard Bhikkhu Bodhi speaking about these. So it's not just the... it's not just the greed of covetousness. It's the really... It's almost like creating that plan to steal something from somebody else. The ill will, it goes beyond just a moment of hatred, and it's when there's these fantasies of killing the other person, or perhaps if a plan of action is put into place with that, certainly. So those are the first two. The third, or they have wrong view. Okay, wrong view. So right view was the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So wrong view, or they have wrong view, distorted vision, thus... There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions. In other words, there's no such thing as moral relativism. No this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously. And on it goes. So, basically, these are beliefs that deny the operation of the principle of karma. These are things that say that has no impact. You can do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. We made, you know, as if the only, as if there are only societal laws, and okay, well, legally you can't do that, or you could get arrested, but there's nothing wrong with it. You know. So anything like that, or that there's no point in giving, anything like that, that's wrong view. And so while these are about actions that generate a course of rebirth, the ethical qualities of actions underpin really all actions, according to the Buddhist teachings. So at levels, at much lower levels, that don't necessarily generate a rebirth. But if we look at like the mind, if you really just watch the mind, you know, those thoughts, the moods, emotions, they underpin everything, you know? This is kind of the stew that we live in. When I had first ordained as a monk in Burma, I was hearing geckos, and I just arrived there. And the geckos are—they're big, and they're pretty beefy. They probably weigh a pound or two, something like that. They're big, and they are loud. They're really loud, and they're nocturnal. So they come by your room or to the building that you're staying in at night, you know, midnight, 1 a.m, and gecko, 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 like 5 times in a row, loud. It's like I was sitting bolt upright in bed there for a while. And right kind of when I'd arrived, I wasn't yet settled. My mind was more restless and anxious and a little irreverent. And I thought they were saying, apologies in advance for my swearing, but fuck you, fuck you. And I thought that was funny. And then after I had been there for a while, and I had been practicing for a while, and the mind was settling more, and it was getting quieting down, all of a sudden I heard that them, and they were saying, Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu. Right, just spontaneously. Bhikkhu means, is a word meaning monk or dedicated practitioner. So yes, the same exact sound, but the mind heart, when we say mind, it does mean the heart as well, how that mind heart underpins everything. I'm sure a number of you have at least some familiarity with Sayadaw Utejaniya, Burmese teacher, who's really a wonderful teacher. You can sign up to get his daily teachings online. They're really wonderful, but like they'll be like a sentence or two sentences come to your inbox, and yeah, really a great Dharma hit every day. But he focuses on the third foundation of mindfulness. He focuses on the mind heart. That's really his primary teaching point, is that. And you can see why. You can see how valuable that is. So now we're getting to the wholesome courses of Kama. So one criticism of Buddhism often is that Buddhism is too negative, or the teachings always say what not to do, or they talk about abandoning this, or that kind of thing, refraining from, but they never say, you know, they never get to the juicy stuff. So we're going to get to some of that. Now, keep in mind, this is juicy stuff in terms of the Pali canon, so it may not be quite as juicy as you would want, but so he says there are three kinds of bodily conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, four kinds of verbal conduct, three kinds of mental conduct, bodily conduct. Here, someone abandoning killing, the killing of living beings, abstains from killing living beings, with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, they abide compassionate to all living beings. So that's the positive state. Oftentimes, in the time of the Buddha, to talk about the absence of something was the equivalent to saying that the opposite characteristic or trait was there in full bloom. But we don't often see that in the words, right? But here, they're gentle and kindly, abide compassionate to all living beings. Number two, abandoning the taking of what is not given. They abstain from taking what is not given. They do not take by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or in the forest. So that's essentially the same as the first one, just the opposite of it, abandoning that. Third, abandoning misconduct and sensual pleasures, abstaining from that list the first time. The four kinds of verbal conduct that are in accordance with the Dhamma, right, that are righteous conduct. Here's someone abandoning false speech, abstains from false speech. When summoned to a court or to a meeting or to their relative's presence or to their guild or to the royal family's presence and questioned as a witness thus, so, good person, tell what you know. Not knowing, they say, I do not know. Or knowing, they say, I know. Not seeing, they say, I do not see. Or seeing, they say, I see. So, they do not in full awareness speak falsehood for their own ends, for another's ends, or for some trifling worldly end. So, abandoning malicious speech, and here's where we start to see some more of the positiveness. They abstain from malicious speech. They do not repeat elsewhere what they heard here and that what they heard there to divide those people. Thus, they are someone who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. That'd be pretty cool. Boy, if at the time of my death people say that about me, that would be pretty good. You know, I'd have made it somewhere. Abandoning harsh speech. They abstain from harsh speech. They speak such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. abandoning gossip, the fourth one. They abstain from gossip. They speak at the right time. Speak what is fact. Speak on what is good. Speak on the Dhamma and discipline. Speak such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Right? It's the verbal conduct. And now the mental conduct. Here someone is not covetous, does not covet the wealth and property of others. Oh, what may what belongs to another be mine? They've abandoned that. Their mind is without ill will, the second one. Their mind is without ill will, and they have intentions free from hatred thus. May these beings be free from enmity, affliction, and anxiety. May they live happily. That's metta. That's the mind of metta right there. The third, they have right view, undistorted vision thus, and seeing the principle of kama, understanding the importance of giving, the importance of generosity, understanding that there are good and bad actions, wholesome and unwholesome actions. If householders, one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish, oh, that on the dissolution of the body, after death, I might reappear in the company of well-to-do nobles, it is possible that, on the dissolution of the body, after death, they will reappear in the company of well-to-do nobles. Why is that? Because they observe conduct that is in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. And then it goes on from there. If they if they had a wish on their deathbed, might ever appear and reappear in the heaven of the four great kings, in the company of the gods of the heaven of the 33, in the company of the Yama gods, the gods of the Tusita heaven, the gods who delight in creating, the gods who wield power over all these realms of the planes of existence, and so on and so forth. And lastly, last thing, if householders, one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct, should wish, oh, that by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I might here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. It is possible that, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they will here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. Why is that? Because they observe conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. The enter upon and abide in the deliverance of the mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. That's a synonym for Nibbana, or the complete and final awakening. And of course, they all, the householders of Sala, all vow to go to him as lay supporters for life. So this is the good news. You know, we get to do these wholesome actions and generate this wholesome kamma. We have that choice. We have some element of choice in every moment. As Philip often says, not perfect choice, but we get to reorient that in our intention in each moment. We have that opportunity to practice with that. That's the good news. Important that this teaching not be used as a way to judge yourself. You may use it to reflect on, it can be skillful to reflect on some unwholesome actions and feel the dukkha of it, feel the pain of it. Use that as a reminder from how we might like to do things differently in the future. But in terms of judging yourself as being bad or comparing yourself to others or trying to fix yourself, those we want to leave by the wayside. This is from a guy named Jeff Foster, who was, I think he was getting his PhD at, was it Cambridge or Oxford? One of those two. And went into severe depression and then had some kind of spontaneous awakening, kind of, and now teaches in kind of the Advaita tradition. And here's a quote from him. "You will lose everything, your money, your power, your fame, your success, perhaps even your memories. Your looks will go. Loved ones will die. Your body will fall apart. Everything that seems permanent is impermanent and will be smashed." Not sure I believe in the smashed part, but... "Experience will gradually, or not so gradually, strip away everything that it can strip away. Waking up means facing this reality with open eyes and no longer turning away. But right now, we stand on sacred and holy ground, for that which will be lost has not yet been lost, and realizing this is the key to unspeakable joy. Whoever or whatever is in your life right now has not yet been taken away from you. This may sound trivial, obvious, like nothing, but really it is the key to everything, the why and how and wherefore of existence. Impermanence has already rendered everything and everyone around you so deeply holy and significant and worthy of your heartbreaking gratitude. Loss has already transfigured your life into an altar." Let's sit for a moment.